Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it's Thursday. It's 2 hours of open forum. Jimmy Akin, first hour, second hour, Mark Brumley. So get ready. We're going to have a lot of fun. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, or especially this first hour, about anything else, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of things, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
And what's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, last 2 weeks we looked at we did a two-part look at dowsing, which contained the surprising revelation that the Catholic Church is actually surprisingly open to the practice of dowsing. They have the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith ruled that although priests should not take part in certain types of dowsing consultations, that they could, that priests were perfectly welcome to do dowsing for scientific experiments, and there were no restrictions on the laity doing dowsing at all. So how about that?
How about that?
But this tomorrow on Friday, we have a patrons questions episode. So we're going to be answering patrons questions like, could pre-Adamites be aliens? What produces crop circles? How much of the mass do you have to attend? Does quantum mechanics imply the existence of God, planetary defense systems, the Max Headroom broadcast intrusion, Belgian UFOs, space, time, and heaven, demoniacs in the Gospels, and the souls of early hominins?
That is fun. Any show where you get Max Headroom and space, time, and heaven in one show, not to mention all that other stuff, that's pretty good. That's a classic Jimmy Akin. What's the Max Headroom thing? Or do you not want to tell me? Is that, do I got to listen?
No. It's a it was an event that occurred, I want to say, back in the 1980s, where there was an episode of Doctor Who being broadcast in Chicago, and someone wearing a Max Headroom mask broke in and ranted for a period of time before they could get him off the air, and then he did it again.
You would think they'd beef up security.
Well, but it was a different station, but the same night.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah. The Max Headroom, I think he was like a soda commercial. No. Was he a soda commercial? What was he for?
Well, he was a soda commercial. He did do soda commercials, but he's originally a character from British television, even though he's played by the American actor Matt Frewer. And he hosted a talk show in Britain, and he also was the star of a short-lived cyberpunk TV series. But he, in case you're not familiar with him, Max Headroom was allegedly the first computer-generated talk show host, but really he was a guy in a mask.
I got it. Yeah. What's that, the 80s? It seems like
yeah.
That. Yeah.
Though they did have him stutter a lot.
Yeah, he had that kind of a little bit of like what do they call that when it's when the little thing is spinning around? A little buffering. It seemed like he was buffering sometimes. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. If you've got a question for Jimmy, you are very welcome to call. And we do have a bunch of folks on the line with questions for Jimmy already. So let me see. You know what, Sarah, I'm going to need you to put the phones on for me for a minute. I got a little computer problem. Colin in Newfoundland, Canada, watching on Catholic.com. Colin, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I know as Catholics what we believe about the Eucharist and transubstantiation, and I know generally what Protestants believe about what they would call communion or the Lord's Supper, be it a symbolic or a real presence view, and that it would be illicit for a Catholic to receive communion at a Protestant church. But what do we believe about Protestants receiving communion at Protestant churches? Is it a good thing for them to do, or are they all inherently some way sacrilegious simply because they don't have valid holy orders and they don't have the sacrament of reconciliation, even if they did somehow have valid holy orders?
So, unfortunately, because Protestantism did not retain the priesthood after the Reformation, with very few exceptions, and the exceptions would be cases where a Protestant church happens to have a minister who actually does have valid holy orders. And there are examples of that, but they're quite rare. You know, like, for example, if a Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox priest converts and becomes a minister or something, that would be one example of how that could happen. They would have valid holy orders and thus a valid Eucharist in those rare cases, but that's very rare. So most of the time, the communion that they receive would be understood as purely symbolic. Now, they may not understand it that way. Our Lutheran friends, for example, believe in the real presence, and so do various other Protestants. But unfortunately, in the absence of a valid priesthood, the real presence would not actually be there. Having said that, if Protestants receive the Eucharist devoutly, whether they believe in the real presence or whether they believe in a symbolic presence or a dynamic presence, they are reaching out to God, and they're trying to fulfill Jesus's will, and they're asking God to bless them. And God can do all those things. So God can still give them his grace, and they can grow closer to God, even though the sacrament is not objectively valid.
That makes sense. It has like a sort of weird thing where it seems like the people who are closer to the Catholic understanding of it are sort of paradoxically less right about their own practice mm-hmm. of it.
Unfortunately, yes, but hopefully in the future, you know, God can work miracles, and maybe in the future there will be a reconciliation where they're able to reacquire a valid priesthood.
Colin, thank you very much. Starting us off there from Canada, we go now to Midland, Texas. Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Ryan, welcome back. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. Hey, Jimmy, I wanted to ask, even though these aren't mentioned in the Bible, where does the church get the traditions of St. Peter being crucified upside down and St. Veronica wiping Jesus' face on his way to Calvary?
Okay, so in regard to the first one, Peter being crucified upside down, that's found in early Christian documents that date from the first few centuries, not the first century, but the first few after that. I don't want to name one because my memory is fuzzy about, you know, what's the first one. But if you get a copy of a book called The Fate of the Apostles by Sean McDowell, he goes through the early Christian records we have and what happened with them. And he has an extensive chapter on Peter because Peter's one of the ones we know the most about. And he'll quote those documents. In regard to the Veronica wiping Jesus's face, it's been a while since I've looked at the sources in detail, but there are a couple of proposals for how this idea originated that I think have some merit. One of them, because the tradition itself is not recorded in any early Christian literature, it's just not there, and that suggests it's derived later on. It's an idea that arose at a certain point in Christian history, and the question would then be, what explains it? Well, it's probably connected with the Shroud of Turin or the face cloth that Jesus was buried with, or what was believed to be the face cloth that Jesus was buried with, or some other similar miraculous image, or image that was believed to be miraculous. The name Veronica is derived from roots that mean true image. And that is a suggestion that that it's based in something that was believed to be the true image of Christ. Like if you fold the Shroud of Turin in such a way that the face is showing, people would look at that and say, okay, that's the true image of Christ. And then to explain it, the idea of a woman named Veronica, or True Image, wiping Jesus's face with a cloth on his way to crucifixion was then proposed as a folk explanation of why the true image of Christ was on this piece of cloth. At least that's one of the ideas that has been proposed, and not necessarily with the Shroud of Turin, but with any of the various true images of Christ that have been reported down through history.
I hope that was helpful to you, Ryan. Thanks very much for the call. That brings us to the first break. We'll take a break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the most famous saints of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Augustine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, but he balanced his genius with humility. Once declared, it was pride that changed angels into devils. It is humility that makes men as angels. He died in 461.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Mark Brumley. Both hours, open forum, and your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Oklahoma next. Robert's in Oklahoma, watching on YouTube. Robert, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, what's up? I have a quick question. The Bible says that the Trinity, or that God is in the Trinity, but it also says that God is one, so which one is it?
It's both. Psychelet, let's suppose I have a three-leaf clover. I have one three-leaf clover that I'm holding up. Is there a sense in which it's one?
Yeah, it's one clover, yes.
Is there also a sense in which there's a threeness about it?
Three leaves.
Yeah, leaves. So we see that a single thing can embody or have the quality of threeness. And that's essentially what we have with God. God is one being who is three persons. Now, unlike the leaves of a four-leaf clover or a three-leaf clover, leaves are parts of the plant, and the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are not parts of God. Persons are not parts. But there is one being, God, who is three persons. And so the oneness applies to the category of being, and the threeness applies to the category of person. So it's not one or three in the same category. The Bible doesn't say God is one being and three beings. The Bible doesn't say God is three persons and one person. Instead, it's one being who is three persons.
Does that help you, Robert?
It helped a little bit. I was doing some studying with my grandfather a couple days ago, and the question came up.
Okay. All right.
Well, an analogy that I sometimes use that is helpful, I think, it's somewhat difficult for us to imagine a being that's more than one person because we haven't encountered any here in this world, and our minds aren't – this is kind of at the edge of our ability to understand, so we have a difficult time visualizing what a tri-personal being would be like, especially a non-physical one that doesn't even have a physical form. But there's an analogy that I use that I think can be helpful. If you think about what a being is, it's something that exists, something that bees. Well, okay, there are different kinds of things that exist, like a rock exists, and rocks are zero persons. You know, there's no person there. Rocks are impersonal. But then there are beings like Psychelet and me, or an angel, and we're beings also. We exist, and we're one person each. You know, I'm one person, Psi is one person, an angel is one person. So we see that being in person are two different categories. And if you have some beings that are zero people, that are impersonal, and some beings that are personal and one person, then you can have some beings, logically, even if we've never met one or seen one, you can have some beings that are super personal, that are more than one person. And so you might think about how some things like atoms and rocks and snowflakes are beings, but they're zero persons. Other beings are like humans and angels are beings that are one person, and therefore it's logically possible for there to be beings that are more than one person, like God.
Robert, that's so nice to hear about you and your grandfather talking about these things. We've got a little book that Jimmy wrote called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. I'd love to send it to you as a gift. If you'd like one for your grandfather, I'll send you two of them. Just hang on and Edgar will get your information if you'd like that book. The number here, 888-318-7884, going all the way down to Miami, Florida now, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Kevin in Miami. Kevin, thanks for downloading our app onto your phone. Go ahead with the question for Jimmy.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I've read a lot and I've watched a lot of videos on just the Catholic view on the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. And so I understand, or at least I think I understand, the transubstantiation part. But I'm failing to put together why the Eucharist is a sacrifice. I know it has something to do with the Old Testament of the Passover meal. I know it has something to do with Christ's ascension and how he took that Calvary up to eternity. But I just can't put it together. And to me, all I'm seeing is, I mean, it's a miracle that this bread is really Christ, but I don't see what we are sacrificing. What is the sacrifice? I'm failing to put it all together. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So first of all, let me comment on how we know it's a sacrifice. And you're correct that it does have roots in the Old Testament. Paul refers to the Eucharist and to Christ as our Passover. So this is the Christian equivalent of Passover. And Passover was a sacrifice, and Jesus's sacrifice on the cross was also a sacrifice. And we have indications in the New Testament itself that Christ regarded the Eucharist as a sacrifice, because what he says in instituting it is, do this in remembrance of me. And it's not as obvious in English as it is in Greek, but the language that is used in Greek is also used for other kinds of sacrifices. And so there's at least a suggestion there that that Christ himself was understanding.
Nope, we had a little bit of a glitch there. We're going to have to, can you guys reload that? And we'll see if we can, let me just make sure sorry, Jimmy, we had a little glitch for a minute.
We elsewhere in first century Christian literature see the Eucharist being referred to as a sacrifice. It's referred to that way in the Didache, which is a first century Christian document that was written around the same time as the books of the New Testament. And then it's unanimous in early Christian literature. You have loads of references in the Church Fathers referring to the Eucharist as a sacrifice. So this is a very ancient understanding. But what is it that we're actually sacrificing here? The answer is Jesus, because he's really present. Well, he's not dying again. That's true. So he's not being sacrificed in that sense, but death is not essential to what a sacrifice is. St. Paul, for example, tells us living Christians to present ourselves to God as living sacrifices. And basically, that points to the underlying reality of what a sacrifice is. It's a gift. When you give someone something, you are sacrificing that thing. You're giving it away. You're not going to have it anymore. And there were various types of sacrifices that were presented to God in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that did not involve killing. So Christ in the Eucharist presents himself to the Father as a living sacrifice. He died once for all on the cross, but he presents himself as a living sacrifice to the Father. And that's the basic reality. of what the sacrifice is. It's Christ himself. Now, there has been a question of, well, exactly when in the Eucharist does the sacrifice occur? And this is something that is a matter not of church teaching, but of theological opinion. And the common theological opinion is that the moment where the sacrifice occurs in the Eucharist is the consecration of the two elements, of the bread, which becomes Christ's body, and the wine, which becomes his blood. When you consecrate those two separately, they are depicted. Now, they're not literally really separate, because his blood is present in his body, and his body is present in the precious blood. But they're at least depicted in a state of separation from each other. And that state of, it's sometimes called mystical separation between the consecrated host and the precious blood, reflects the separation of Christ's body and blood on the cross. And that's been identified by many theologians as the point in the Mass where the sacrifice is made. It's in that mystical separation, but not literal separation of his body and blood. However, what is certain is that the sacrifice himself is Jesus offering himself to the Father on our behalf.
Kevin?
Yes.
No,
yes.
Was clear to you?
I don't know if you were waiting for me to.
No, that's okay.
Yes.
That was awesome.
Okay, that was awesome. I thought so too. Well, thank you very much. Jimmy pulls off awesome even when there's a minor glitch and we lose him for a few seconds. The number here is 888-31-TRUTH. We are working on that glitch, right? Yeah, we are. Okay. Jeff in Chicago, Illinois, watching on YouTube. You're next, Jeff. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi,
so
Jeff.
So thrilled to be on the show. Can you tell me what we know about both the similarities and the differences theologically, politically, between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? And what do we know about the role or roles the two played in the arrest, the trial, and the crucifixion of Christ?
Well, let's answer the second question first, because it's a little simpler. It doesn't appear that the differences between the two groups had a significant role in the arrest and trial and crucifixion of Jesus. Both members of both parties were on the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin, and at least the majority of the Sanhedrin thought Jesus was a threat, that he was going to be a political messiah who would start a war with the Romans, and they didn't want that, so they had him convicted as a false king, as a messianic pretender who was a threat to Roman authority, and got him crucified. But it seems that they put aside their differences in doing that because members of both parties thought of him as a threat. In terms of what we know about their differences, well, one of the differences is that the Sadducees, at least for the most part, were more associated with the temple in Jerusalem. There were priests who were Pharisees, so it's not like all priests were Sadducees, but the Sadducees were more popular with the people. The Pharisees were more popular with the people. The Sadducees were a kind of smaller elite group that was common among the Jewish priesthood, whereas the Sadducees had a broader base of popular support among the ordinary people. In terms of their beliefs, the Pharisees believed in an afterlife. They also believed in angels and ghosts, whereas the Sadducees did not. They thought that when you die, you're just worm food, that there is no afterlife, there are no angels, there are no ghosts, and once you die, that's it. And any blessings you're going to get from God, you're going to get them in this life. The Pharisees also had a mixed view on predestination and free will. They thought the two were compatible. The Sadducees did not think that, and they believed in free will to the exclusion of predestination. In terms of politics, since the Sadducees were a more elite group, they were more allied or at least tolerant of Roman rule, whereas the Sadducees chafed under it more. They weren't full-blown zealots in resisting Rome, but they weren't as friendly to the Romans as the Sadducees were. In fact, the Jewish historian Josephus records that when the entire Roman people paid tribute to Augustus Caesar by proclaiming him the father of the nation, there were 6,000 Pharisees who refused to swear that oath. And so they were not as friendly to Romans, but they could cooperate with them out of practical necessity.
How's that, Jeff?
That's great. Were there any sympathies from either of the two towards Christ that we know about?
Yes, we know from the Gospels that there were members of the ruling council who were sympathetic to Jesus, like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. There are also places where Jesus says positive things about Pharisees. He even tells one Pharisee he's not far from the kingdom of God.
Jeff, thank you so much for the call and the question. The lines remain quite full, so we will take a very quick break and then be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the feast of St. Catherine Drexel, plus all the latest news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akins, our guest, and I have not been doing a good job with Alice in Rochester, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Alice has been waiting, and I missed her. Alice, are you there with us?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sorry I kept you waiting, Alice. Alice?
Mm-hmm.
How old are you?
Seven.
Well, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
If Adam and Eve did not sin, would there still be heaven?
Well, we don't know the answer for sure, but this is a matter of opinion. Some people have been of the opinion that if Adam and Eve had not sinned, then of course, they would not have died, and that might mean that they didn't go to heaven because they wouldn't need to. They just would continue living here on earth in paradise. Other people, though, and this is more people, have been of the opinion that even if they did not die, that they still could effectively be in heaven, because what heaven really is not a place as much as it is a state of being in union with God and having the spiritual vision of God. There's a fancy term for that. It's called the beatific vision. Beatific means happy, and having this beatific vision of God makes you happy, which is why it's called that. And so, even though they would have continued to live and not die, Adam and Eve, some people say, could have had this beatific vision from God, and that would enable them to effectively be in heaven and on earth at the same time.
Okay, Alice?
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate that. Maybe we'll talk to you again sometime. Let me see. I've got lots and lots of full lines, so off we go. Back we go to Joey in Sacramento, California, listening on the EWTN app. Joey, thanks very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I have a question about the sex abuse that went rampant in the church. I would like to know who authorized for the abusers to not get excommunicated and get shuffled around the parishes around the world. And why weren't they excommunicated and punished?
Okay, they weren't excommunicated because the law does not contain a provision for excommunicating people who commit sexual crimes like that. The number of things you can be excommunicated for is actually very small. And like, for example, if you commit murder is a murderer is not automatically excommunicated. It tends to be crimes of a specifically religious nature, like desecrating the Eucharist or physically attacking the Pope or committing heresy that will result in you being excommunicated, because the function of church law is to deal with religious matters principally. It's not to deal with secular crimes. So the church leaves it to the state to punish secular crimes like murder or sex abuse or things like that. Having said that, there are penalties that someone who commits sex abuse in the church is going to have to face if they're a priest, or, you know, if they work for the church or something like that. There are penalties, but excommunication doesn't happen to be one of those, because that's not really the function of the church's judicial system. In any event, that's kind of a short form answer. I don't want to go too deep into that, but that's the short form answer. In terms of who shuffled them around, it was the local bishops. And in doing that, they were following the advice they were being given by psychologists at the time. Psychologists at the time viewed pedophilia as a treatable condition that people might commit but then could be treated for and not commit again and lead a productive life, and you could safely put them around people, including children. And so that's what the psychologists were saying. And so the idea was, well, this guy has committed sex abuse here, so we're going to move him out of that parish so he's no longer around those same people, and then we're going to get him treatment. We're going to send him to a psychology clinic for a while, and then we'll put him somewhere else where he doesn't know anybody and they don't know him, and so they won't be scandalized by his previous behavior, and he can, after his treatment, lead a productive life. And so that's what bishops were being told by psychologists at the time. Unfortunately, psychology is kind of a squishy science, and it turns out that people who commit pedophilia cannot be as easily treated as the psychologists used to believe. And so these days, the church has adopted a policy of, if you do this, you are out of ministry permanently.
And Joey, I'm going to leave it there, because as you've heard me say, there are lots and lots of folks on the line. I hope that was helpful to you. Joey, if there's more follow-ups, just give us a call on another day. Saul is in Fresno, California, listening on Spotify. I'm not used to having folks listening on Spotify, Saul. Are you there with us?
Yes. Oh,
hi, Saul. How old are you?
I am 11 years old. Well, and a half, sorry.
11 and a half. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Aiken.
Okay. So, my question, hello, my question was, if I ask God a question and I'm waiting for that question, how do I know if it's God or Satan that answered that question?
Well, okay, so if you ask God to answer a question for you, those are two of the options. It could be God that provides an answer. It could be the devil that provides an answer. Or it could be you that's providing the answer, because you might perceive the answer to be something, and it might be just your imagination, or you might be misperceiving something. So there are really at least three options for who could be responding to an answer. It could be God, it could be the devil, it could be you. And sorting those out is a challenge, but there are a couple of general principles that I would suggest. The first one is if the answer seems to conflict with Christian teaching, including Christian moral teachings, if the answer suggests doing something wrong, then you can pretty much count on that not being from God. It could be from you, it could be your own perception, or it could be from the devil, but it's not from God if it conflicts with Christian teaching, including Christian moral teaching. If it does not conflict with Christian teaching, if it's not recommending that you do something bad, then I would say the next step is to save that one for a third. The next step is experiment and see if it's successful. And if it's from God and it's something that's okay, God will help you out. And as you experiment with the answer, God will help you in that situation, and you're more likely to have success. Another thing that I would suggest you do is talk to your parents about it. If you think that you've gotten an answer from God or from the devil, talk to your parents. They might want to consult a priest. They might want to call here, Catholic Answers Live, and ask me what they think of the answer. But getting extra opinions from competent people like your parents or a priest or someone who studies these matters like me could also be of help in figuring out the answer. Is there a particular answer that you've received that you're wondering about?
No, not currently. I was just wondering if that ever happened.
Mm-hmm. It does happen. God does sometimes speak to people. He gives them what are called private revelations. And sometimes the people who receive private revelations are not sure if the answer is coming from God or if it's coming from the devil or if they're just imagining it. Sister Lucy from Fatima in 1917, she as a little girl received a revelation from God. Specifically, God had sent the Virgin Mary to speak to her. And at first, she wasn't sure if this was from God or from the devil. I talked about that on my Mysterious World podcast. I believe it's episode 40. And if you and your parents would like, you could go listen to episode 40. You could just go to mysterious.fm/40, and you can hear about Sister Lucia and how she figured out that it was really the Virgin Mary that God had sent to speak to her.
Okay, Saul?
Okay. Thank you for this answer. It was wonderful. And thank you for
awesome.
Answering this call.
Well, you were a wonderful caller, Saul, so thank you. Jimmy, you wanted to say something to Saul?
I was just going to say, my pleasure, always happy to help out.
And Saul, you brought us right up to the break, so we're going to take our break, and we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Aiken on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Praise your ministry. I went back to the church after 30 years of staying out of the church after finding your radio station and ministry on terrestrial radio. It wasn't even the internet. And I've been back and I've been evangelizing, you know, and using some of your responses to questions.
Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Killett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is Open Forum. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be with us, and we will continue with Open Forum. 888-318-7884. I think your microphone is open in there. Conrad in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. You are up next, Conrad. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you for answering. Jimmy, question. What happened to Moses and Elijah after the transfiguration of Jesus?
Well, it depends on the way. It depends on the way in which, well, where they went was heaven. And that's where they had been before the transfiguration. The question is complicated by the fact of it's not entirely clear the way in which they manifested during the transfiguration. It could be that they were not there physically on the mountain. It could be that they were like a vision, a mental projection that the disciples perceived by God's grace. If that's the case, well, they never left heaven, and so they didn't really go back to heaven. The mental vision of them just stopped manifesting, and they continued to be in heaven like they had been before. On the other hand, if God enabled them to physically leave heaven and appear on the Mount of Transfiguration, then when the experience ended, they would have gone back to heaven, and they, in a literal sense, they would have gone back there. Now, how that worked, just like Jesus did at the Ascension, how that works is something we don't know a whole lot about. We don't understand the way space works in heaven. But regardless, they were in heaven before the transfiguration. They were in heaven after the transfiguration. And they may or may not have left heaven during the transfiguration.
Makes sense, Conrad?
Makes sense. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. I'm going to go up to New Hampshire now. Jeremiah, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Jeremiah, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you very much. I was recently reading the General Instruction of the Roman Missal lately, and it said in paragraph 199 under the section 2, stated concelebrated Mass, in paragraph 199, it says, this is the last part of the paragraph. Every priest, however, is allowed to celebrate the Eucharist individually, though not at the same time as a concelebration is taking place in the same church or oratory. However, on Holy Thursday and for the Mass of the Easter Vigil, it is not permitted to celebrate Mass individually. So that means, it seems, means that he has to concelebrate the Easter Vigil Mass. But later on in paragraph 204...
If there's more than one priest in the church celebrating Mass, they have to concelebrate, yes. But if there's if there's only a single priest in the parish, he doesn't have anyone to concelebrate with.
So that's perfectly acceptable, and that explains the common practice in many parishes nowadays where there's not many priests.
Exactly. Often just one priest. And that addresses what you needed?
Yes, that does. Thank you very much.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you very much. And I don't know if you have a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. But if you don't, I'd be happy to send you a copy. Just hang on the line and Edgar will get your information and we'll send it off to you. We're going now to John in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on 90.1 FM. John, thank you for the call. Go ahead with the question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a question in regards to the Old Testament, where we have some things that you could look at and go, this is not meant literally, this is meant for the reasoning behind the story. And a certain amount of that seems pretty easy to understand. One part that I wonder about is the longevity of life in the Old Testament, where you have some individuals that are living 800 years and longer. And what is the is that meant to be literal? And there's something that has changed. Does that have another purpose? What's the meaning behind the importance
of
that?
This is a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of church teaching. But what most biblical scholars have concluded is that in the early part of Genesis, specifically the first 11 chapters, there is a substantial amount of material that is of a symbolic or non-literal nature. And that's not to say it's not communicating truth to us. It is communicating truth to us, but it's not meant to be understood literally. And an example of that is the extraordinary lifespans of the patriarchs before the time of Abraham. The one of the reasons that people have thought that is because there are numerical patterns in those lifespans. It looks like they may be designed according to some kind of mathematical plan that you would not expect if people were living to various ages. You know, you wouldn't expect this kind of mathematical patterns to keep cropping up. To cite an obvious, and some people have proposed that these mathematical patterns are tied to astronomy. An obvious example of that is the patriarch Enoch. Saul Sykelet, do you happen to know off the top of your head how long Enoch lived before he was taken according to early Genesis?
No, I do not recall that.
365 years.
That...
Do you know any other significance to the number 365?
That's the number of days in a daily defense plus one in a year.
In a year, yes. And so it looks like Enoch's age may be based on the length of the solar year. And it's been proposed that some of these other ages are may be based on other astronomical phenomena that the ancients were familiar with, because they watched the sky all the time. I mean, they didn't have TV or internet at night, so they watched the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason. Another reason is obviously humans don't live anywhere close to that today. And then a third reason is we find similar massive ages in other ancient Near Eastern literature. So like if you look at Mesopotamian literature, they will also describe their ancients as living to fantastically long ages as a way of showing how great these mm-hmm. ancient heroes were. And so you could understand these fantastic ages in early Genesis as communicating something similar, saying like, hey, our ancient heroes, our ancestors, they're just as great. And so that may be one of the things that's being communicated under the symbol of a fantastically long lifespan.
What do you think about that, John?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, you know, so, you know, there's things like with, the 7 days in a week, and you go, well, were these things made in 7 days? And you know, I can easily see that one being two different things. Like, I could see that being literal, because there was no 24-hour day period when this started. So what is a day? A day is whatever God wants a day to be.
And so,
but I also see in there a meaning that it was a prescription for the amount of for how we should live a weekly cycle and mm-hmm. give a day to the Lord. So I didn't know if anything with those days meant something deeper, but that does help understand. You know, maybe they saying somebody lived 1,200 years was value related.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Well, none of them lived 1,200 because none of them got up to 1,000. But you're on the right track. When it comes to the days of creation, the Catechism of the Catholic Church says that they symbolically, the 7 days symbolically represent the work of the Creator. And it obviously fits the work of the Creator into the framework of a Hebrew week, and that does teach a spiritual lesson to the ancient Israelites that they should honor the Sabbath day. Also, it's pretty clear when you do a careful study of the 7 days of creation that they're not meant to be literal, because, and there are various, I won't go through the whole thing right now because we're getting close to the end of the hour, but these are clearly meant to be 24-hour days, or they're depicted as 24-hour days because you have morning and evening in each one. There was morning and evening the first day, morning and evening the second day, and so forth. But God doesn't create the sun until day four. So how do you have morning and evening with no sun? Because the ancients knew, just like we know, that it's the sun that lights up the sky and makes the daytime. So that's a pretty good sign to the audience. These are not meant to be taken literally. And in fact, they actually are structured in a very specific way that, unfortunately, I don't have time to describe right now, but there's a hidden structure there that has been talked about for centuries.
Is that one you've done on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or no?
I know I mentioned it. I also gave a talk on it at one of our Catholic Answers conferences a few years ago.
Thanks very much, John. Appreciate that.
Oh, there's a three-parter on young Earth creationism. If you Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Young Earth, the three-parter will come up, and I believe it's in part one that I discuss the days of Genesis.
Thanks, John. I'm going to try to get Brandon's question in from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Brandon, can you be quick with the question so Jimmy can get you an answer?
Absolutely. Afternoon, gentlemen. I'm just trying to figure out why Matthew chapter 17, verse 21 is missing.
Okay. Whenever anyone asks about a missing verse that's not in a particular Bible but is found in other Bibles, the answer is always the same. This is a general answer. It applies to all cases of this. Anytime anyone wants to know why is this verse in one Bible but not in another Bible, here is the answer. There is a difference in the manuscripts. Some manuscripts have the verse, some manuscripts don't. And modern Bible translators have to choose which manuscripts they are going to translate. And so Matthew 17:21 is a verse that was in many manuscripts, which is why it ended up getting a number, 17:21. But it's not in, now that we have dug up more ancient manuscripts, it's not in the earlier, better manuscripts. And so most modern Bible translations no longer include this verse because it appears that it was not in the originals. Now, what this verse says, it's in the Exorcism of the Young Boy about that kind only comes out with prayer and fasting. Well, that is actually found in Mark 9:29. And it looks like what happened was the original Matthew did not contain that verse, and later a scribe who was copying Matthew remembered Mark 9:29 and accidentally put it in Matthew. And so that's how we think it got into Matthew. It was a scribal mistake. But now that we have other ancient manuscripts of Matthew and we can look at them, it appears that it was not in the original version of Matthew. And so that's why it's not in most modern Bibles. But that's always the answer. Whenever the question is, why is this verse not in this Bible? The answer is because there's a difference in the manuscripts.
Brandon, I am going to leave it there because the music is playing, and that means we got to take a quick break. Hey, if you're on the line, stay on the line. Mark Brumley is going to be here with us in just a few moments, and we will continue with Open Forum. If you haven't called yet, there are three lines open, 888-318-7884. Whether you are a believer or not a believer, Catholic or not a Catholic, you are welcome to ask your question about the Catholic faith of Mark Brumley coming up next hour, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much. I feel like I haven't seen you very much this week, but it's very nice to see you for this hour.
Likewise.
All right. See you next time. Well, no, we'll be right back right after this with Mark Brumley, Catholic Answers Live.